Chapter 5 takes us into looking at some issues of cognitive development and innate cognitive processes. A lot of this, of course, as so many things in psychology, takes us back into the original nature-nurture debate, which actually predates psychology and gets back into philosophy. So you have the British empiricists versus the nativists, philosophers fighting in the streets of Paris and London in the 16th century, mad, crazy. Okay, it wasn't that big. They'd write nasty letters to one another, occasionally bitch about things at conferences. Basically, the British empiricists argued that you were a blank slate at birth, so-called tabula rasa, and all of your experiences are what made you what you were. The nativists said, no, you were born with certain abilities, innate abilities, native abilities, and of course you learn other stuff, but it's a combination. As it turns out, we see the same argument from philosophy sort of fought out between the ethologists and the behaviorists in the early 20th century in terms of relevance to psychology. Ultimately, it turns out that the nativists and the ethologists were correct in this case. We do come born with certain innate processes, abilities, behaviors, predispositions, but we also learn other things, and the environmental processes can alter that. When we look at cognitive development, we can, of course, talk about developmental progression, and a lot of developmental psychology has adopted evolutionary components, evolutionary psychology components, over the last 15, 18 years to consider progress through developmental stages. And this actually raises a very interesting question about various stage models of developmental psychology. So, for example, the most famous being Piaget's stage model. How much of a sudden transition is there then between these stages, and how gradual is it? Is it just blah, 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 and now moving from stage 2, 2, 3, boom, like going, say, you know, off a gravel road onto a paved road, or is it a more transitive process? And if it's more of a gradual transition, why is that? Is that due to environmental factors? Is it due to genetic factor interaction between them? If stage theories are taken to be extremely sudden, then we have to go back to the idea that this is due to some sort of very hard genetic coding. Because environments are so, if you will, variable, if you will suddenly, bam, transition point, we have to make the argument that we've almost got a genetic determinism in here. And we don't think things quite work like that. So, consequently, more recent work on stage theory is saying that, you don't necessarily get these hard transitions. You may have individuals that are back at an earlier stage in some capacities, and yet are at a more advanced stage in other capacities. So it's a much fuzzier boundary. That doesn't make diagnostics easy. It actually makes it more difficult, okay? Especially when you try to apply it to individuals. But still. Another concept here is what's called the epigenetic landscape. Now, this one says that, sure, there's an overall genetic predisposition for the progress through development. And we typically, when we talk about psychology and development, we usually think about child development, but frankly, you keep going through development throughout your life. Okay, so there's, from the womb to the tomb, there is developmental, psychological developmental progress there, or the progression at least. And sure enough, there does seem to be a certain amount of biological regulation to this. Now, the concept here, the epigenetic landscape, says that to really strongly perturb an individual away from this biologically predisposed progression through development, there has to be a pretty strong environmental disruption. Something very extreme has to happen. If you only have something a bit extreme, it may cause a temporary disruption. If you will, think of it sort of like this. You've got, you were a stream, okay? You were a stream. the dike has been opened, water is flowing, it's going along a channel. To be able to actually divert this channel, you need to like toss a rock into the stream. Okay? If it's a moderate size rock, there's some splashing, the stream gets a little bit rough, and then it keeps on going. If it's a bigger rock, the stream may sort of blow up and divert around the rock and keep going down the channel. Okay, so there's a period where there's some perturbation away from this more typical developmental process. But it's going to take something pretty big to actually cause the stream to completely head off in a different direction. Generally speaking, the stream will get back on track, more or less. Okay, so that's sort of the idea here. And that's an idea that's been coming in over about the last 20 years in developmental theory. Now, specifically with respect to cognition, then, and our brain's cognitive capacities here, there are very broadly, two broad interpretations of what the brain does, how it does it. The first says the brain is a domain general pattern classifier, that your brain is extremely flexible, and that it has, in fact, evolved to be able to do just about anything. If you're particularly up on computer terminology, some people would say that the human brain is essentially a biological Turing machine, or a Turing computer, which is a universal computer that could, in theory, calculate anything, given enough time. So the idea of pattern recognizers says that the brain's job, more or less, at least the cognitive, higher cognitive functions, are to look for patterns, to recognize patterns in the crazy randomness and massive amount of information that is out there in the environment. Contrast this with the domain-specific idea of the brain. Now, there are obviously degrees to this one. So in the extreme case, you get some that argue that the brain is pretty much entirely made up of a whole bunch of individually evolved innate modules. Each module has evolved to do a very specific task, and the module can only do that particular task. Now, if you follow this sort of extreme domain-specific interpretation as conclusion, it means that we should expect to see various errors that will occur when the brain encounters certain types of situations in the environment, because it simply hasn't evolved something to actually cope with these things. Less extreme forms of the domain-specific interpretation say that there are at least some cognitive modules that are task-dependent, but then perhaps there is some general pattern classification system as well. So keep that in mind. All right. Now, what do we mean when we talk about pattern recognizers or pattern classification? I'll give you a few examples. You ever heard of reverse speech? Probably have. You may just not know about it. David John Oates has become sort of the modern proponent of reverse speech. He's down in Australia. What Oates has tried to convince people of for a number of years, and he convinces some, but generally he's got a conspiracy-minded fringe group that will buy into this. What Oates argues is that what you really mean when you talk can only be understood if you listen to what's said backwards. And Oates argues that somehow, some of us at least, our brains are so good that we can actually understand the real underlying meaning behind, say, politicians or newscasters or just individual people's words, because somehow our, at least a few people's brains, including his, can do this, transpose this into reverse. This will give great insight. And if you follow his teachings, you can learn to do this as well. Evolutionarily, of course, this makes no sense whatsoever. But we'll give some examples here. So,
more energy and money and effort.
Okay, so there's a little clip.
More energy and money and effort.
Okay, so more energy and money and effort. And then if you play it backwards, it says you get this.
terrifying, you know, need.
So this was a little snippet from American politician talking about the economy. He says if you play it backwards, you get "you're frightened, lean on me," and that's what the politician is trying to influence people: elect me because you're frightened by the economy. If you'll just go with me, it'll all be all right. So of course you only get that if you can listen to it backwards. Buy my books, buy my DVDs. Pretty impressive, actually, to get "you're frightened, lean on me." That was pretty clear, right? So, is there something to Oates's interpretation here? Well, interesting study by Ramez, Rubin, Pizzoni, and Carroll from 1981. They demonstrated speech perception without traditional speech cues. What they did was basically set up sinusoid waves. Okay, so listen to this. Now, where's my? Listen to this.
It was a sunny day and the children were going to the park.
Okay. Here's the sine waves again.
It was a sunny day and the children were going to the park.
Did you get that before you were primed? No, most people don't. I have heard this so many times now that anytime I hear that kind of sign, that particular sine wave pattern, I can't help but do it. But yeah, and this is what they did. They just one example of their work from the study was they just play random. They just randomly get sinusoid auditory stimuli. It's no voice. There's no speech in it at all. It was computer generated. Just computer generated random noise. They play enough of them. You know, they generated enough randomly, and then they sat there and went, "I don't know, what do you think you hear?" And I don't know. I go, "If I had to guess, it's a sunny day and the children are going to the park." Excellent. There, we came up with something. Let's play that for subjects. You know, what do you hear when you just hear the scientists? Listen to the priming. Bam, there it is. You get it. So once you've been primed, you can pull this stuff out pretty easily. So, again, generally, when you play something backwards, if you take Oates' idea here, this would be the idea. It's just a general pattern classifier. If you've been told by Oates, if you listen to things backwards, you'll hear the real meaning, then you start looking for meaning. Ever watch any of these ghost shows, Ghost Hunters or whatnot, where they're... It's like, here, you hear that? Yeah. I think it sounds like "help me" or "get out." Okay. And if you ever watch any of these sort of ghost hunters, like ghost hunters in Japan or ghost hunters in, it's like, why is the ghost always speaking in English? I mean, really? It's like, oh yeah, there's people that died here in the 17th century in France, and they're talking to you in modern English. Well, yeah, because they're ghosts, right? Because ghosts can do the... Wait, didn't you earlier say that ghosts are tied to their time period and therefore they have a hard time? They're perhaps they're not intentionally evil, but they're confused by modern phenomena? Yeah, I did say that. General pattern classification. If you are a ghost hunter or think that you are a ghost hunter and someone is saying... There's a ghost here. Did you hear that? Yeah, you're going to start listening. Your brain, you've been primed. It's primed the brain. It's primed the general pattern classification system. Okay. More broadly, this is perhaps more well known as pareidolia. It's the phenomenon of perceiving familiar patterns in random or non-relevant structures. The face of Jesus in a piece of toast. Seeing a ducky in the clouds up above you, right? Not clouds like today, which are just gray and leaden, but get go out on a day when it's sunny with some cumulus clouds, lie there, you're actually doing schoolwork, you know, and see what things you spot in the clouds, right? It's pareidolia. Is there really a cat in the cloud? No! Your brain's just put something up there. Your brain looks for patterns. So our neurobiology lets us recognize people, process language, identify predators, and do all this really important stuff. Our brain does amazing stuff. We're pulling patterns out of all kinds of things. Right? If you've got, let's see, if we've got, oh, walking along and you see this tiger. Well, why? It's not a complete tiger. It's only the front half of a tiger. I mean, it's only got one leg. How much danger are you from like half a tiger with one leg? I mean, seriously, why? I mean, if it's still alive, you still got to walk right up to it and, you know, put your foot in its mouth. It's, no, but we don't do that. We don't go, oh, no, that's not dangerous. That's only part of a tiger with one leg. It's like, oh crap, you know, the rest of the tiger is there behind the tree. Right. We fill it in. We look for a pattern. Okay. So could be very useful, right? Our general pattern classification is really useful. But sometimes, because we've probably been so evolutionarily selected for to find patterns in all the noise that is out there, that we find patterns where none really exists. False negative. But, right, it's probably better, it's probably safer for us to see patterns where they don't exist, by and large, than to miss, you know, a one-legged tiger. The other three legs are still there, it's just behind the tree. It's probably better for us to get it wrong occasionally when it doesn't hurt us than it is for us to make a mistake when it really is dangerous. So, we could say then that pareidolia, and pareidolia specifically refers to visual stimuli, but we're talking most about auditories here today, that pareidolia is a byproduct or a spandrel of the selection for these other extremely useful neurological pattern recognition abilities, okay, things that we're very strongly selected for. This is just an ancillary byproduct, right? There aren't really things up in the clouds besides water vapor. But I mean, seriously, how does it really hurt you that much? When Simba in The Lion King sees his dad up in the clouds, I mean, he's just probably tripping out on some bad bug he ate. It's, you know, giving him a bit of... No, I mean, it's his own little pattern classifier there. If you've been primed by the baboon there to tell you what you're supposed to be seeing, then sure. Priming will do that. Try it sometime with kids, you know. Do you see anything in the cloud? I see a horse. Yeah, I see a horse too. Right? You can prime them this way. All right. Here's a few other examples just for fun. Go with the Doors. Treasure's there. Okay. Just a little snippet here. But if we play it backwards, what do we hear? Well, F me. The Doors are like Satan worshippers. It's like, I am Satan. You're probably too young to remember this stuff. I'm actually too young to remember this stuff as well when it first came out. But this was huge. Late 60s, 70s, right? Rock bands are putting reverse satanic lyrics into it. You got to play it backwards over and over. But there's a... Okay. But if you just take the Treasures there, I am Satan. But you got to cut the tape at the right place, because if you let it go an extra half second, what do you get? I am Satan Schmangel. Schmangel. Sounds like something out of Lord of the Rings. I am Satan Schmangel. Gollum. Okay? Where are you going to cut the tape? Well, if you've decided that the rock band's putting satanic messages into the music, you cut it when you hear what it's like, I am Satan. Oh, Schmangle. Oh, sorry. For a second there, I thought the Doors were putting... No. They're just talking about some guy called Satan Schmangle. That's not Lucifer. That's not the devil. That's somebody else. That's okay. No, you cut it where you want to hear it. Okay. Well, we already talked about ghost voices. You know, the so-called electronic voice phenomena. Incidentally, for most of these electronic voice phenomena, they're using some pretty sensitive electronic audio recording apparatuses, and they crank the gain way up. They don't usually tell you that in the shows. So when they're hearing, because you have to, because ghosts are quiet, right? But I mean, you end up picking up all kinds of, a pipe goes bing somewhere else in the house, or something rattles two floors away. You might pick it up, and if you're looking to hear something, you hear something. So-called, most paranormal investigators are not actually very scientific about things. They don't do blind studies. Watch these sometime. Well, hey, it's in the reality programming sort of vein of things here. Watch one sometime. They'll get the people who supposedly have the haunted house that had somebody in, and they'll prime. They'll actually prime the person. It's like, well, we found something pretty interesting here, but want you to listen to it. It's not like, we've got 10 clips of things, which may or may not have been recorded from your house. Please listen to the following and see what you find in any of these. That would be the right way to do it. Well, it's still a flawed way to do it, but it'd be a better way to do it. But they don't do that. They prime the people whose houses. It's like, oh, we found something pretty interesting. We'd like you to listen to this here. We can't explain it. See what you think. Well, of course. It's like, yeah, I hear it too. Okay. And then we just get sort of some zaniness. They just took down the one that I wanted to use for this, so we'll do a different one. And it just goes on and on. Anyway, the point is it's a Latin song, O Fortuna, as popularized by Karl Orff's rendition, which is now used in just about any fantasy movie that has ever been done over the last 30 years. And it has become a bit of an internet meme where people try to come up with their own, what they hear in this. You can poke around with the rest of it, there you go. So it's the same sort of idea. Now, I mean, again, unless you speak Latin and are good at picking Latin out of chanted voices, you're going to have a hard time figuring out what that's all about. But if you're relatively good at English, you start putting your own words to it. So all kinds of examples like this on YouTube. There's some fun ones from some Bollywood songs as well. But again, it's part of the pattern classification. You can find something else that will fit. So the point here, I think what I'm trying to say at this point is our brains are good general pattern classifiers. We got that. Now the question that comes in sort of from the evolutionary psychology perspective is, do we have dedicated innate modules that do very specific things? And if you remember when we talked about the Santa Barbara School, they say yes. Matter of fact, original sort of take on this was yes, and we have lots of them. Now this comes back from, introduced this briefly, earlier work by Fodor from 1983. Fodor introduced the concept called modularity of mind. He said different brain systems are only going to work with certain kinds of data. Other information may be available, but it is not going to be utilized. This is what he called module impenetrability. Now, Fodor was working primarily with the perceptual system. He was talking about this in terms of the sensory perceptual system. So he said, your perceptual system is going to be made up of a bunch of independent perceptual modules, and each one will have its own very particular little job to do. You say, well, why would you need that? He says, well, because this lets them work independently. They can work in parallel. So you can process lots of different types of sensory information all at once very quickly. Your brain doesn't have to do just one thing at a time. Now, undoubtedly, you have gotten into this. You know, if multiple people are talking at you at once, how many conversations can you really attend to? You don't have kids, I don't think, so this probably is not such an issue for you. But I've got, you know, three kids, one wife, three dogs, one cat. And sometimes it's just like, all of you, shut the hell up. You, go. Okay? It's tough. You can only focus on so much at once for these higher cognitive processes. Now, what if you had to do that? You know, you see something, you know, boom, something's running towards you. Uh-oh, what is it? Process. Orange. Process. Black. Ah, process. Quadruped, process, loud sound, you've just been eaten by a tiger. No, you get it all at once, right? You get the auditory, you get the different visual sensory, you get issues about speed, you get issues about directionality. Is it coming towards you or away from you? By having a whole bunch of independent little perceptual modules, each doing a very specific thing, probably keeps you alive. Now, Fodor did say that's the perceptual system. He said, oh, your cognitive stuff. He says, you know, you got to have central cognitive processes here. And he said, these are non-modularized. These are, in fact, slow. If you got to stop and think about something, it's going to take time. Why does thinking about something take time? Because you don't have an innate module that's going to handle it. And why would you? Fodor argued, because you're going to encounter all kinds of different stuff. You know, innate processes are only, or innate modules are only as good as what you've been exposed to in the past. As you get into higher cognition, you're going to experience things that you've never experienced before. You wouldn't expect there to be a module. I'll give an example of a module here, discovered almost accidentally, as it turns out, by a guy called Ken Chang. Ken's down in Australia now, but he actually works with Dr. Spetch here in the department fairly frequently. Ken used to work with pigeons and rats and monkeys, oh my. Now he works almost exclusively with honeybees. He said there's really nothing that's in terms of being interested in things like cognitive spatial processing, there's nothing that you can't do with a honeybee that you can't really do with a person. And he said the advantage, or a rat or a pigeon, he says that, of course, the advantage with honeybees is you get honey. So they've got so many. No, I'm not kidding, really. They started out doing this sort of stuff. They'd have a few hives of bees, and they just give the grad students, hey, here's 4 liters of honey, go. Because you got to take the honey out of the hive at some point. And then they started getting more and more beehives, and more honey. And eventually they start selling it, because got to get the honey out of that. So they've actually now, they're funding some of their own research by the honey coming out of their hives. And I mean, there's not much you can fund with a rat. I mean, really, what do you get from a rat that anyone's going to buy? Got a lot of rat poo? Compost? Garden? Anything? No? Yeah, not much. Okay, so this was back when he was working with rats. What he found, interestingly enough, was that rats will, under certain environmental conditions, actually entirely ignore salient landmarks. It's like they just don't exist. And the landmarks can be blatant. And they will instead use the spatial geometry of the environment to navigate. Now, this is odd, because when he discovered this, other studies had shown, like with radial arm mazes, that in fact rats will use landmarks to navigate. And he found that they wouldn't do this. So here's what he worked with. He had a rectangular arena here, training arena. I'm just using these little shapes in the corners to represent the landmarks. He did use things like shapes. He used different sets of lights. He painted different walls, different colors. He had olfactory cues, all kinds of things. Well, maybe the rat just can't see it. Their eyes, maybe they're, well, they're actually, the rat's eyes are okay. But, you know, even with olfactory cues, which are amazing for rats. So I'm just using these. Now, so it's about a 4 foot by 2.5 foot box. Floors covered in wood chips, a few inches of wood chips. The rat gets put right in the very middle. In each corner, there's a little can, basically a little tuna can, that's got a little bit of rat food, rat pellets down in it. So up in this corner, there's a little can buried there. And the can's got a little has got some saran wrap over the top, so the smell of the rat food doesn't get out. So basically, the rat has to find the can, dig down through the sawdust, the wood chips to get to it, and then he can very easily rip through the saran wrap to eat the food. So the can that gets buried in the corner that's associated with the square landmark always has 18 little pieces of food. The can that's in the corner associated with the diamond always has 6. The can in the corner associated with the circle has 1. And the can in the corner associated with the triangle never has any food at all. And what Ken was trying to get the rats to do was go from highest to lowest. So go to the 18, eat the 18 first, then the 6, then the 1, and really not bother going to the 0 at all. So he goes through a bunch of training trials. And then to see whether or not the rats have learned the landmarks, he rotates them. So a 180-degree rotation and a 90-degree rotation. So 180-degree rotation, the square goes down to the bottom left and then over to the bottom right corner. So everything rotates halfway around. 90-degree rotation, everything only moves like one side down. Now, as it turns out, so during testing, there's no food in the cans, right? It's just a null, it's just a probe trial. But he sees which corners they go to. As it turns out, the rats do pretty good in the 180-degree rotation, but they suck at the 90. It's like they got no idea where they're going, it seems. Here's what happens. If we assume that the rats are ignoring landmarks, we can describe the environment based on the geometry. So we've got long walls and short walls. Now, we can therefore define each of these landmarks by the geometry. So the square landmark, if the rat is running towards the corner with the square landmark, it's got a short wall to its left and a long wall to its right. If it's running towards the corner with the diamond, short to the left, long to the right. If it's running towards the corners, well, with either the circle or the triangle, short wall to the right, long wall to the left. Now, it was completely coincidental that Ken decided to put different amounts of reinforcers in the different ones, and it was also just coincidental that he put the two highest reinforcer values kitty corner across from each on the diagonal, so the 18 and 6. Wasn't any particular reason he did it that way. He just set it up somehow, and that's what he did. If he'd done it a different way, things would have been a little bit different for him. In fact, actually, if he'd done it a different way, he would have figured this out a little bit sooner. So, when we take a look at this here, on the 180-degree rotation, Well, look, both the square and the diamond still have a short wall to the left and a long wall to the right, and same as during training. And the circle and the triangle both have the short to the right and the long to the left. Now, when he went back and reanalyzed the data a little more carefully, he found that, in fact, the rats were not actually distinguishing between the square or the diamond. They were going to either the 18 or the 6 first. They were going to one of the two high corners first in training. And same thing here. They'd go to one or the other. It was random. But once they go to one and find out how much is there during training, then they can do the rest of it. Then they know exactly where they are. So they would go to one of these two first and then head off to one of those two. In the 90-degree rotation now, we've got our square and our diamond now have a short wall to the right, long wall to the left, and our circle and triangle, short wall to the left, long wall to the right. They go to the wrong places. The rats are still going to one of these two corners, now marked by the triangle and the circle, which would be the low landmark reinforcers. They seem to be going to the wrong place if they are using landmarks. If they're using the spatial geometry, they're going to the right place. Now, you might say, and in fact, that's what happens. You might say, how can the rats be so dim? How can they not figure this out? Are their eyes not working? Are their noses not working? No, it's fine. The only reasonable explanation here is that we've got what's called a geometric module that is impenetrable to other information. You might say, well, wait a minute. Didn't you say earlier the things like a radial arm maze, that the rats can do that? Yeah, they can. So you've got radial arm maze, part of the tiger. Remember what a radial arm maze is? You got a central platform, something like that. Okay, so the rat starts there, and it has to run out along these little pathways and get to each end and find parts of food there. Now, typically when you do this, you put posters and things on the walls around this, some landmarks, and the rats do just fine. They have no problems with this. Take that stuff away, they're lost. They don't know where they are anymore. Don't do a radial arm maze. Do something like this. Do that. Square arena, the rats use the landmarks. What's the difference between that and the rectangular arena? Symmetry. The rectangular arena is asymmetric. In fact, if Cheng had used trapezoidal arena, they probably always would have gone to the 18, 6, 1, 0. So first, second, third, fourth. They probably never would have made mistakes between the 18 and 6. You can't tell them apart. So it seems that this is how rats work. If you have got useful information, if you've got an asymmetric environment, use the geometric shape. Use the environmental parameters first. Use the geometry. If you do not have geometry to make use of, then you have to use landmarks. And go, why would rats evolve that? Well, think about where rats are a lot of the time. Nowadays they're in sewers and stuff like that, but I mean, out in the wild, they'd be out at night, it's going to be dark, they're going to be going through little mazes and warrens, they dig burrows, they're going to be scuttling under underbrush and stuff like that, trying not to get eaten. As soon as humans started showing up and building cities, they're running through back alleys. Geometry probably does a great job for them. geometry is probably super. Most of, I mean, it's pretty unusual in the real world to find something that's perfectly symmetric that you're actually going to wander around in. I mean, even this room isn't perfectly symmetric in terms of things. So, geometric module. So in this case, landmark information is available to the rats. They just don't use it until they absolutely have to. So once the geometric module can't work, boom, then they default down to the use of landmarks. Okay, so that would be a module here. Now, 1982 in The Adapted Mind. Kazemide and Tubi put forward what has come to be called the massively modularized view of the brain, sometimes also called the Swiss Army knife model. So you know the Swiss Army knife, it's where you take out, you've got a knife on it, you've got a bottle opener, you got a little saw, you got a toothpick, you got a corkscrew, you got a pair of scissors. You keep pulling different tools out, okay? Their idea here, as it was sort of originally put forward, or at least as it was generally understood, was that evolution had produced, selected for, a whole series of very specific cognitive impenetrable modules. And so whenever you encounter something, your brain defaults down to, goes through its little Swiss Army knife, pulls out the appropriate module to handle the job. And again, with the view that our modern brains are really coming out of Pleistocene evolution, so selective pressures back from the EEA, they're saying that, you know, we would have had lots of time to evolve these various, very specific cognitive modules. In this sense, it's a fairly extreme, heavy-duty, nativist perspective. Now, remember, I mean, we talk about this from a nativist perspective. It's like, yeah, there's genetically predisposed sections and a certain amount of learning. Cosmic Institute weren't denying that there's learning in there as well, but they're saying most of this stuff that's important for humans, cognitively important, is going to come from these modules, these cognitive modules. So they went and said, yeah, Fodor's idea of the perceptual modules, yeah, of course, obviously, that makes sense. But we're saying there's also all these cognitive modules, that our cognition is not just a general processing system, but that it is a cognitive modularized system, that we have specific cognitive architecture that just does particular things. Now, so, okay, what about that? Well, I mean, you look at something like language. You know, if I take a ball peen hammer and hit you twice about there and about there, boom, you know, I take out Wernicke's and Broca's area, you are, to use the technical term, hooped when it comes to both language production and comprehension. That's a fairly specific chunk of brain. It's a fairly specific little cognitive module, if you will. That being said, sometimes people who have had strokes or damage to the Wernicke's and Broca's area, 15 years later, they start talking again because the other side of the brain or some other chunk of brain takes over the function. So, But those are unusual. So, okay. Let's take a look at this. Now, if we take the very extreme perspective that there are cognitive, innate, impenetrable cognitive modules for everything, a fairly obvious criticism of this would be, but doesn't this mean there shouldn't be very much in the way of flexibility? If you're only capable of dealing with previously evolved problems, things that we encountered back in the EEA, how do we deal with recent development? How do you drive a car? Right? Oh, well, no problem. There could be a cognitive module for working your foot and some cognitive modules for hand-eye coordination and some perceptual stuff. It's like, yeah, but is there, what module puts it all together? Okay. So, now to be fair, Cosmides and Tubies weren't themselves, some people have misinterpreted this, weren't themselves saying, no, they weren't saying that you can't learn things. So they weren't saying that there was no general processing abilities. They just thought that most of the big stuff that we do in terms of our cognition follows a modularized sort of path. But still, there is this issue. What then allows for the integration of different modules? What happens when modules have to work together? How much of that is controlled by some sort of central general pattern classification system? One way that was attempted to sort of try to get around this was to use what were called actual and proper domains. An actual domain of a module is anything that's going to satisfy its basic requirements. The proper domain of a module is going to be the stimulus or stimuli that, by activating the module, gives its adaptive value. Excuse me, I hate to do this, but just missed its gone. Find out who that was later. So, actual and proper domains. Give you an example. Bug detectors. Okay? Frogs have cells in the visual system that fire when small objects move in particular ways. So if you got a frog, right? Pet frog. Call him Kermit. I don't care. Whatever. You got a pet frog. And fly goes in front of it. Out goes the tongue. In comes the fly. Okay? So a little speck moves in front of the frog. Tongue goes out. Comes back in. Bug detector. Right? It's trying to get the frog fed. Now, if you flip a little tiny pebble, a little rock chip or something, a little spitball in front of the frog, bleh, tongue's going to go out and come back in as well. Now, I mean, the little tiny rock or the spitball, it's not food, but it activates the same neural detection system. Okay? So, in terms of what we call proper and actual domains, flies are the proper domains. Okay? Flies are what the system evolved to actually work for. I mean, you go back in time when frogs were, you know, first evolving, there was no psychologist or even probably any primate that's going, hey, you want to have fun? Throw little rocks in front of frogs. Well, you know, Paleolithic frogs or something, proto-frogs. No, there's nobody around doing this. If something small went in front of the frog, it was probably food. Okay, so that's the evolutionary pressure on the frog. So that's the proper domain. Stones become an actual domain. Incidentally, if you take a little tiny bit of hamburger make, or a little tiny bit of meat or something like that, chop it up really small or make a little tiny hamburger ball, boop, toss it in front of the frog, zoop, zoop, grum, gotta be eaten. Now, in that case, this little tiny bit of meat is not just an actual domain, but it's also part of the proper domain. I mean, it's not a fly, but it's protein. The frog can digest that. So it could be, it could fit both of those bills there. Okay, so in this way, you can say, well, you know, so modern things, right, modern things that didn't exist back in the EEA, you know, as long as they're close enough to the actual domain, we can call them the proper domain, and sure, they can still activate one of these innate cognitive modules that was evolved to do something entirely different. So here's here's a question. Does modularity actually preclude developmental change? So if you've got this heavily modularized cognitive structure, can the system change with development? We mentioned developmental change earlier. Carmeloff Smith, developmental psychologist, has said, well, maybe the way to look at this is a little bit different, is not to think of this in terms of these actual individual cognitive impenetrable modules, but she says, we should think about how evolution would select for these domain-relevant predispositions or biases in what we do. And she said, if you take a look at child development, she says, you know, we think we can parse child development in children trying to understand three things, what she calls biology, physics, and psychology. So she says, these are the domains that children, young children, have to try to figure out. Now, by biology, physics, and psychology, she doesn't actually mean learning the taxonomic names of a moose, Elsie's, or, you know, E equals MC squared. She means biology. How do you tell if something's alive? Well, it consumes things, it moves, okay? Things like that. So things that move, consume things, interact, are probably alive. Physics. Stuff falls. If you push it off your high chair, it falls down. If you bang on a pot, it makes noise. Yeah, that's physics. Psychology. Smiling people are happy people. Faces are what you should attend to. If somebody points, you should look. Psychology. And again, if you spend any time around young kids, you'll see them doing this stuff. This is what they are learning about. She says, these are the domains that you have to work with. She says, what happens here is experience allows you to focus, you focus your attention. So these domains, focus your attention onto relevant things, and you learn from them. So it's not modules. You don't have a specific module for pushing the pot, either in its proper or actual form, you know, off the edge of the high chair. It's just domains. You attend to stuff falling down, because you can fall down. That hurts, so you learn from it. She says, though, but by the time you've got adults, by the time you get up to adults, adults have done so much, have had so much exposure to things within these domains, that they're practically, they seem to be modular-like in the structure. Adults don't have to keep, you know, they don't have to go to a restaurant and, like, push your fork off at the fancy restaurant just to see what's going to happen. You know how stuff falls down. It actually messes with people in some interesting ways. So, I was reading about this earlier today. So you're on the moon. If you let go of a rock, what's it going to do? Okay, float. Fall slowly. Okay. So if you think it's going to float, you've probably seen footage of like the astronauts on the moon, right, walking around. So if the rock's going to float, how do the astronauts stay on the ground? Heavy boots. Not really trying to make fun of you here, but you're right. It's going to fall slowly. The moon has gravity. It's just not particularly strong compared to the Earth. 1/6. If you drop something on the moon, it will fall slowly. That's why the astronaut's going to walk around. People have a problem with this. They don't have experience with the moon. So they haven't had a chance to play around with that. Okay. So, anyways, she says, once you've done enough of this, once you get enough experience, by the adult, your cognitive processes seem like they're modules. You're so fast, you're so good at this. She calls this representation, she says also what you start to get into is called representational redescription. You move beyond just encapsulating little factoids of information. Things start crossing domains. Why is it that a car, which moves and consumes stuff, gasoline, oil, whatnot, and then we sometimes talk to it, oh, come on, start, I'm late for work, please start, right? Why is the car not alive, and yet the family dog is? We've got to start to figure that out. We've got to start combining these different domains, psychology, physics, biology, together. Because this allows children to move from implicit representations into abstract representations. If you've ever dealt with young children, they're not particularly abstract. Matter of fact, we'll come back to this later. They can't really deal with a lot of abstractions. They just aren't developmentally capable of doing this. Okay? They don't get it. They can't get it. It takes until they're a little bit older. As a matter of fact, it takes until kids are about 4 to 5 before they really have a complete adult, what we call social cognition. They need a bit more experience to get adult good at it. Of course, some adults need that kind of experience too. But developmentally, it's going to take them a little while to do this. And Carmeloff Smith is arguing that this isn't due to any sort of cognitive, innate cognitive modules that are there. It's due to being exposed to all of this information. Presumably, if you were to lock some kid in a room for 8 years, this is really going to slow this down. They'll be at a real deficit. Question, of course, at that point is, can they actually recover from it due to critical developmental periods? All right. So what about something like face recognition? This is something that, for example, Cosmide and Tooby have argued will be really, really important for humans. we tend to face is really, really early on. So how do we do this? Their suggestion is that it's a module. We know that infants can respond to faces early, within hours after birth. And the suggestion here is that, you know, there's a graded neurological brain region response is something very specific about faces. They don't respond to anything. They don't respond to, like, footballs or pictures of cars or whatnot. They respond to faces. Okay. Interesting study by Gauthier and colleagues from 1999. Now, they worked with adults, not children here, not infants. But they got people that were bird watchers and very knowledgeable about cars. So, bird experts and car experts. Okay. They showed these different groups of subjects, the bird expert and car experts, pictures of faces and birds and cars. What they found, that was both groups of subjects, particular region of the brain, they pop people into an fMRI. Okay. So in the fMRI, particular part of the brain lights up when they're shown faces. For the bird watchers, bird experts, same area lights up when they're shown pictures of birds, but doesn't light up when they're shown pictures of cars. For the car experts, same part of the brain that lights up with faces, lights up when they're shown cars, not when they're shown birds. What Gauthier and colleagues are arguing here is this great neurological response in the brain to being shown faces is not specifically a face module, but it's a categorization module or system or network. Not for something specific, not for something impenetrable, but for stuff that you get really, really familiar with. We get familiar with faces really, really quickly. We see a lot of faces, the argument would be. What do you see most of? If you're a little infant and you're being born, as we discussed, essentially prematurely, your visual system only gets you to see about a foot beyond where you are, 30 inches away from you for the first few weeks of life, and everything's pretty blurry. People hold you up and look at you, hold you right there. What do you recognize? Well, faces, and if you're breastfed, boobs. Okay? If you're bottle-fed, bottles. Those are probably the most familiar things that you're going to see for the first couple of weeks of your life. You get really good at spotting them really, really quickly. And we keep paying attention to faces as we age. Faces give us all kinds of information. If you become an expert in something else, birds, cars, whatever it is, then this activates the same chunk of the brain. Okay, social cognition is another one here. Now, when we talk about social cognition, we're talking about language, culture, politics, anything that deals with the social structure. Reciprocity, cheating, promises, these sorts of things. Any sort of cognition involved with making decision-making with respect to other humans is what we would call social cognition. Excuse me. Somebody just keeps phoning me. I'm not expecting anything going on, but let me check this.
Don't expect
people at home heading to hospital. Okay. Right. Social cognition. Okay. So, right, this is where we've got decision-making interacting with respect to human systems. Now, this is not unique to humans. We see this in other species as well. Humans are just better at it than most of us. And as I said, adult humans are really good at it. Young humans aren't so good. People that can lie convincingly and get away with it are really good at this. Ever watched young kids try to lie? Yeah, they're not good at it. Yeah.
You know, all the psychopaths are like.
Oh yeah.
Is that like almost an evolutionarily kind of advantage?
The psychopaths are interesting. For a long, well, why don't we hold that thought? We'll talk more about psychopaths as we go here. Okay, so hold the thought on psychopaths. Okay, so within social cognition is what's called theory of mind. Go back to good old René Descartes. I think, therefore, I am. Okay, René Descartes also came up with the Cartesian coordinate system, the XY axis for graphing stuff. But psychologists tend to remember him for this. Okay, I think, therefore, I am. Now. Theory of mind, that's not a theory of mind. That's saying that you have a mind. That's what Descartes is saying, essentially. I'm thinking, therefore, I know I'm thinking. I know I'm thinking because I'm thinking about the fact that I'm thinking. I'm thinking about can I think, which means I have to think. You get the idea, right? You know that you think. How do you know that anybody else thinks? That's when you get into what's called theory of mind. You are theorizing that others have mental capacities that work in a way similar to yourself. So if you will, it could be, I think that you think and that your thoughts drive your behavior. That would be a theory of mind. So you go to theory, then you need to start looking for evidence for it. This actually gets tricky because obviously the contents, the components of somebody else's mental state might be very different from your own. Or from the reality of the situation. I mean, consider a schizophrenic. From a paranoid schizophrenic's perspective, you all are insane. Why don't you know that the sky dragons are coming to make me the king of the universe? That's actually a real one. I'm not making that one up. Okay? Why don't you understand that I've come up with a way of producing free energy and time travel? Why don't you know that the government is coming to kill me? Why can you not figure this out? It's self-evident. From this non-schizophrenic's point of view, it's like, no, but how can you actually believe that? That makes no sense. There's no evidence for that. Well, at best we can say here, you know, at worst you go, that person is just nuts. At best, you go, there's something very different happening with the way their mind is functioning. Okay? So, we can talk about this in terms of what's called intentionality. Intentionality is a way of sort of categorizing states of mind about beliefs and desires and things. It's a reflexive hierarchy. So a first order intentionality statement is dealing with what we might call belief or desire of you. So I believe. This would be Descartes' I think. I think, therefore I am. That's a first order statement. Okay, so the fact that you know that you have a mind, that you think about stuff, that you are cognitively active, that's first order intentionality. Second order intentionality, that's where we get into theory of mind. I believe that you suppose. I think that you think. I believe that you know. I think that you feel. Okay, that's second order. So that's the theory of mind. Then we can keep going. No third order. I believe that you suppose that I want this. And so on and so on and so on and so on. I believe that you think that I'm going to cheat you. But I know that you, blah, 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 blah. It goes on and on and on. Many, many sitcoms are all predicated, and Shakespearean plays, are all predicated around confusion resulting from higher order intentionality. Okay. How far can you take this? How many levels of intentionality can you go with? Kinderman and colleagues, 1998, looked at this. They gave people little vignettes, little stories, short stories, if you will. And let them read the little short stories. And then they asked them questions about the mental states of the people that were in these little stories and facts, specific facts about things that happened in the stories. What they found was that people were all good up till about fourth order intentionality. So I believe, for example, I believe that you think that I intend to deceive you. That would be like a fourth order statement. So they're asking subjects to figure out these increasingly complicated, you know, what do you think the characters in the story think about one another or the actions and how they're... Okay. So they had the questions all worked out there. what they found was beyond about four orders of intentionality, men in particular started to have problems. Women did better, like fifth and sixth sort of thing. But beyond fourth, men started to have difficulties with this. Women started having difficulties a bit later, but women definitely could get up to higher order intentionality more easily than men on average here. Some people looking at this said, well, no, probably what's happened is once you do get up to these higher orders of intentionality, you're just asking things that are so cognitively taxing, you're just stressing the cognitive abilities, that of course it's going to break down. They said, no, that's why we tested for facts as well. We'd ask some pretty obscure facts, and people did better at that. And there wasn't really a sex difference. So it's not just that the higher order intentionality is cognitively hard to do. Specifically, it's social cognition. Beyond a certain part, so not all, this is what I was saying, not all cognition is created equal. We've got cognition for various stuff, whatever, spatial cognition, these things. We've got social cognition. So little factoids in there, people were good at that. Some pretty complicated facts, but starting to have problems beyond about four orders of intentionality, especially for the men. Women could do this a little better. And in terms of where this is happening, a lot of this is happening up in our frontal neocortex. And Kinderman and colleagues suggest that the reason that humans are so good at this is we've got massive frontal neocortex. Right? We got a lot of frontal neocortex. Compared to other primates, we're packed. We're packed up top, okay? Hanging right there over your eyes. That's our social cognitive. Does a lot of other stuff, but that's the big social cognitive chunk of brain, okay? Why might women be better at this than men, do you think, from an evolutionary perspective?
They're less social.
Women are less social? Oh, more social, yeah. Why? So that's sort of approximate, or maybe at best developmental. What, can we take it down a little bit more? Why might women be more social? Yeah.
Their aggression, like a dominance, is mostly
like social based. Okay, their aggression and dominance is more social based. Okay, but again,
where male social hierarchies are more physical.
Physical. Okay. Okay. Now again, why? Can we take that down to a more ultimate sort of? Can we take it down from the proximate a bit lower? Think back to, we've talked about this a little bit, EEA tribal structure. Who's doing what? Division of labor? Talked about that? Males are probably the ones out doing the hunting. Things. Yeah, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just wondering to say that
that was a stretch.
Like, social roles about how women probably have more time to do that. Just to throw the thing, the ones like staying home with their kids and around other women, while men
Yeah, it may not necessarily just be the they've got more time to do it. They may have to do it as well. May not be. Women also seem to be better at multitasking on many things than men are, especially if it's something that's social in nature. Better time managers there in general. You got kids you're dealing with. You got other people's kids. You got other women in the group. Maybe some men that are still in the group during the day. So you got a lot of stuff going on. Men may have been back in the EEA off much more by themselves or very small groups, a couple of guys hunting together or off individually. So probably some differences there. Women were probably evolutionarily selected for to be better at it. The women that were better at this did better in group. They were more successful. The more successful you are in your internal social hierarchy, what a success for your kids are going to be. We talk about this with chimpanzees, right? The status of male chimpanzees, especially for bonobos, but also for the common chimps, very tightly linked to the social status of mom. Here's some developmental benchmarks in terms of theory of mind. And these are sort of broad dates, but less than 18 months, so up to 18 months of age, what kinds of things are happening here with respect to social cognition? Kids are developing joint attention. These are what we call intentionality detectors, eye direction detectors. If anyone's worked with autistic kids, this is in fact something that's very difficult. Autistic kids, many of them do not do eye contact. Really, really important. Okay? So eye tracking is a biggie. Understand what people... It's also really important for language acquisition. So we'll talk about this later when we talk about language, but, you know, if someone's talking about, hey, this table that's here, and looks at the table, gestures at the table, young kids will, after about 6 months of age, is like, oh, everyone else is looking at the table. I'm going to look at it as well. And so they hear this word, table, 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 while everyone's looking at the table. It's like, ka-ching! I think we will call this table. What's fun to do is get some other people involved in it. Look at the table, but talk about cows. Cow, 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 cow. Especially if there's a little kid there. You see where this is going, don't you? Totally messing with them. Don't do it with your kid. Do it with somebody else's kid. Okay. Other thing that starts happening up to 18 months, there is self and social referencing. Okay. So difference between me and others. Between 18 to 24 months, you sort of get into increasing amounts of pretend play. Your primary, what are called primary representations. This is fun, I want this. Desire psychology comes into this, you know, understanding internal drives. I am hungry, I am tired, I am sad, these sorts of things. Sometimes a little bit of why as well towards the later period here. Around about 36 months, you start getting into secondary representations. So, beliefs about beliefs. Here's our second-order intentionality. Up to about 24 months, and somewhere between, you don't really get into second-order intentionality in kids until somewhere, usually, there's exceptions, but usually 24 to 36 months. Okay? So, young kids can't actually lie. They might by accident. Did you do this? No. They might just have forgotten. Right? If it was hours ago, they won't remember. But they can't actually intentionally deceive. Because to be able to intentionally deceive, you have to understand that somebody else thinks about stuff in a way that you think about. Right? So, example I often give my son, right? Getting into this 36-month to 48-month period there. So if looking back on this with Elliot, you know, the pre-three-year-old phase with inability to lie, you know, then you get into it a little bit later, and it's like, come into his room, and the room's just a disaster. It's just been trashed. It's like, what happened here? What have you done? It wasn't me. Well, it wasn't you. Who was it? Ninjas. Came in through the window. Did this. Ninjas. Yeah. In black. Except for one who was wearing white. Ninjas trashed your room. Uh-huh. Really? At this point, the gears start. At this point, I'm not even that upset about the room. It's just like the little gears are just like, he's not buying it. He's not buying it. He's not buying it. I thought he'd buy it. Ninjas on dinosaurs! It's like, oh, ninjas on dinosaurs, huh? What kind of dinosaurs? Like the Tyrannosaurus, but the smaller ones. Raptors? Yeah, ninjas on raptors. Well, since the ninjas aren't raptors here, you'll have to clean it up. Aww. You shouldn't let ninjas in through your window. There you go. But, yeah. What's believable for a kid? Ninjas. Of course ninjas would do it. And what's even more believable? What else would trash something? Raptors, of course. Because what else would a raptor do? Put them together, you've got ninja riding raptors, and of course it's a recipe for disaster in the room. He got that he should lie, or at least he got that he thought that he should lie. But, so he managed to lie. but he wasn't very good at it yet. I'm proud to say he's gotten better at lying over the years. Well, anyways, you get better at it as you go. So, you know, social cognition starts coming in around this period. Ever seen parents in stores or caregivers in stores with little kids and kids doing, or on a playground or something, and it's like, you know, the kid's maybe under 2 years of age, and it's, I don't know, one kid takes toy from other kid, and it's like, you got to give the toy back. You can't just walk over to John and take his toy from him. You know, how do you think John feels, right? The adult is trying to reason with the under 2 year old. How do you think John feels? There is no light on, right? The kid's this is like, I feel. Below 24 months, you got desire psychology. You got first order intentionality. I feel, and I felt I wanted the toy, so I took it. Well, how do you think John feels? Does not compute. John feels something. I don't know. I mean, the kid isn't even going to say it. I don't know. He just can't get it. Until you get into second order intentionality. I mean, the kid might, if this sort of thing happens a lot, that the kid will learn what to say back. Right? He doesn't get it. He doesn't really understand it. Okay? Just, you can't. Social cognition isn't there. Start to understand his or her own drives and desires and wants. But the fact that anyone else has stuff? Ba-ba. Can't work. 48 to 56 months, you start getting into what's called, between 48 and 56 months, we kick into really full social cognition. It's pretty much completely, if you will, online. Today, actually, apparently, is International like Geek Day, so I'm going to try to, you know, use things like online and stuff like this. So, a lot when we talk about children, you know, they're little, wetware computers just come online, so there we go. So between 48 and 56 months, you know, 4 to 5 years of age, kids essentially achieve adult social cognition. They got, I mean, assuming you're dealing with normal child, not cognitively delayed or something like that, they got everything an adult's got. They got the full social cognition package. They're not necessarily very experienced with it. Right? So, I mean, like, they can lie. They can know when they should lie. They can try to come up with a lie. But they may not be really great at lying to adults. They may be okay with lying to other kids. But they get better, right? The whole package is there, but they need to work it. They need experience with it. Okay? But at least you can just like, well, how do you think John feels that he took his toy? How would you feel if I took your toy? Well, I wouldn't like it. Okay. How do you think John feels now? Look at him over there. He's crying. How do you think he feels? You know, he's probably sad. Why do you think he's sad? Because I took his toy. Right. They can get it at that point. Okay? Now, again, we've talked about the fact that we're born, you know, stunningly prematurely. And you got to think about this. Here's another little interesting tidbit of info. Once you hit about 4 to 5 years of age, kids can move at the pace of adults in, say, like a hunter-gatherer type of progress, okay? Actually, it really surprised the hell out of some people here. We used to have two profs here, Cornell and Heth, that did spatial navigation stuff. They wanted to find out how people got lost. We worked a lot with kids. They found out that by about age 5, kids could just, they could motor. It's like, no, they can't get that far. You know, the old wisdom was 4 or 5-year-old kids can't get that far. Turns out they can just go, and it turns out they can remember stuff. It's like, so they did one study where it's like, okay, take me to the furthest place you can think of, and the kid would go, okay, and just take my hand, off they go, and they'd be walking and walking. It's like, where are we going? It's like taking you to grandma's house. Like, grandma's on like the northeast end of Edmonton, and like they're leaving from the university. Now the kid probably gets lost along the way, but I mean, he's just going. I was like, okay, didn't think they'd do that. So here's where I'm going at with this. 4 years, 5 years of age, they can start getting pretty far away from mom and dad, right? below that, they don't move too fast. They kind of tire out a bit unless you kind of force march them. And they're going to stick closer. They're going to stick a bit closer. If you're closer to your parental caregivers, your kin, right, they're probably going to be helping you out, right? I mean, you know, your kin isn't really going to do probably too much that's too bad to you. But you start being able to wander further away. You might be encountering people that you're not related to. At that point, is this person lying to me? Are they telling the truth? Should I manipulate them? Should I lie to them to get what I want? Interesting issue. A lot of this stuff all seems, it's correlational, right? But a lot of stuff all seems to come up around this 4 or 5 years of age. Okay? Interesting things. Just really quickly, false belief test can be used to demonstrate this. Got a kid, really simple test. You show them a little box of Smarties, and you rattle, 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 and you say, what's in here? And they go, Smarties! And you go, you open up, and it's like there's like crayons or something in it. It's like, ha, 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 it's funny. And then you say, okay, oh, hey, put this back together quickly. Hey, if we ask Bob over there, we ask Bob, what's in this? What do you think he's going to say? If the kid says, crayons, it's like, you failed the false belief test. If they say, oh, Bob's going to think there's Smarties in here too, right? The false belief test is, if you know something, do you think everybody knows it? Like my daughter at, she's 4 now, so she's just starting to get this. But I mean, through last year, it's like, she knew something, everybody knew it. It's like, you knew the water was pouring out of the bathtub. Why didn't you come and get us? Huh? She knew it, so everybody had to know it. You know what I want? No. Why not? I know what I want. You must know what I want. How can you not know what I want? Thinking at you, okay? So, there's another test called the Sally Ann test, which is done similarly with dolls there, but can you pass the false belief? This is, so we get into what's called meta-representational thought at this point. Really abstract reasoning. So that's what the 4 to 5-year-old range there. And essentially at that point, they've got adult brains. Just needs more experience. Okay, we're done for the day, and as it turns out, we seem to be done for the week. So, next week,